Hey guys, if you're enjoying listening to The Front Lounge with Kongos, make sure you subscribe on Google Play, Stitcher, and iTunes, as well as listening on our website. But most importantly, tell your friends about this podcast and spread the word.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome back to The Front Lounge with Kongos. Today we are going to do a special episode. We've had some great guests on the last few, and now we figured let's do one with just us four, and let's talk about something that hopefully our music fans will be interested in. We're going to do a track by track of our album Lunatic, because Lunatic was the sort of album that broke us out, and maybe we'll do, you know, every 10 episodes we'll do something like this. So we just thought we would talk about each song and give some insights and some stories that all the interviews that we've done have not been able to pull out of us. So, before we do that, you want to do breaking news?
Yeah, let's do brief breaking news. What's new?
Danny's trying to sell all his synths. That's the most recent news.
Yeah, well, it's currently going on right now. No, I'm trying to sell a couple synths. It's been a few weeks of denial, basically, because I have an OB6, which is a modern Dave Smith Instruments polysynth, and a Moog subsequent 37 CV, and they're really amazing. You know, if you're going to get modern synths, they're up there with some of the best ones to get. And then we brought our dad's Jupiter 8 out to the studio here in LA, and I slowly started to realize that it just sounds better.
And, well, yeah, specifically, yeah. Danny and I were in the studio the other day trying to get a low bass synth sound,
yeah,
and we're trying to replicate it on the Moog, and just we weren't getting anywhere. And I don't think it was our we knew what we were doing,
right? Yeah.
And then we switched on the ARP Odyssey,
mm-hmm.
but that's a
reissue. It's like a recreation, but
yeah, it was just different because we got that sound in like 10 seconds, and it sounded exactly right. So.
Yeah.
Danny's now getting rid of it all and going all in on some
vintage
thing,
yeah,
from the 60s or 70s.
I've seen different theories as to it. You know, like they were using different alloys and bigger circuit board. They all weigh a lot. So there's a combination of things. They're both more imperfect and more perfect. They're more perfect in certain ways because they have lower noise floors. That they used more metal for all the circuitry. And then certain of their circuitries led to imperfections where all of the VCOs, which are the things which make the pitch in the synth, they kind of drift, and they drift in a nice way. So I'm not an engineer, so I can't explain why they sound better, but they just sound better.
Well, you were saying, because we were looking and listening to the Yamaha CS80, is that it?
Yeah.
And that you'd recognize the sounds from that if you've seen Blade Runner or anything like that. A lot of those sounds are CS80 sounds. That thing weighs 200 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
It's a keyboard. It weighs 200 pounds, and it costs
$20,000.
So
yeah,
we're going to start a Kickstarter fund on our podcast called Buy Danny Whatever He Wants. Because I think we can actually relate this back to our childhood, you know, when he was, what, probably 3 years old, you know. We would go to the grocery store with our mom or whatever, and we could not walk past the checkout aisle without him wanting to buy something. It didn't matter what it was. You know, I think that
it was mostly toy guns. Yeah. But,
yeah. Any kind of toy, you know, it's the classic thing at a grocery store with a kid, but I think maybe Danny had that the worst.
I'm by far the most materialist.
I don't know. I just, speaking of used gear, I just bought some speakers. You know, I decided that I spend probably half of my life, if you add up the hours, thinking or working on sound and caring about sound, you know, and we spend thousands of dollars on equipment to make our records. And then at home, I find myself listening to music on like a little Bluetooth boombox. And I'm like, what am I doing? I spend my whole life trying to make good sound. And then I'm listening on this little piddly thing that has it doesn't reproduce the sound. So I start down the rabbit hole of looking on Craigslist and OfferUp and eBay for some vintage speakers, and that's like up at 2 a.m. just looking at vintage speakers.
I have a feeling a lot of people who work in an industry like that, whether it's being a chef or a musician, they end up doing the like the antithesis of what they actually work in. So they'll go work in amazing restaurants and with all the best ingredients, and then on their way home they'll go pick up, you know, fast food or something like that, and they'll just eat shitty food.
Well, like some guy who works on, you know, 70 millimeter film, and he's color correcting for hours at a time, and then he goes home and watches TV on his iPhone, you know.
Yeah. What did David Lynch say? People, like, movies belong in the theater. Stop watching them on your fucking phone. Okay, he's partially right and he's wrong.
But I've been feeling that more so now because we've been going a little bit more to see movies at the theater, and it is a nice experience with a good movie. You just forget that you actually watch it. You don't check your phone and see what's going on.
The key is it being a good movie. Like, that's fine for him to say that, but they've just started making shitty movies for the past 20 years. Like, there's a way higher percentage of shitty movies that who cares what medium you watch it on, it's still crap.
I don't know if that's literally true. It's just that we're living them in real time now. I think movies are pretty good lately, but they're like anything. The rare ones are rare.
Yeah. Like, well, I want to go see that new Paul Thomas Anderson movie. What's it called?
Phantom Thread.
Phantom Thread. Makes it sound like a Star Wars movie, but it's actually about a fashion designer. Yeah.
Daniel Day-Lewis, he stabbed himself with a sewing needle every day for 17 years to prepare for the role.
Method.
Yeah, he tied thread around his finger really tight.
I was saying he's always doing old-timey stuff. It would be nice to see him play something modern. You know, what if he played like a programmer?
Daniel Day-Lewis?
Yeah.
What if he's actually not from the present?
Right, yeah.
He's actually from the past, and he can only do old-timey movies because that's who he is.
I think he's, whether you think he's the best actor of our time, as everyone, most people seem to say, is whether you agree with that or not, what is really cool about him is he literally has only ever done a movie that it seems that he's into.
Oh, yeah.
There's no like, oh, Daniel Day-Lewis just did that movie for the money and did some shitty action movie. Like, he just does what he wants only when he wants
to. That's why he's always retiring after every movie, because they always say, Daniel Day-Lewis's last movie. But I think his policy is to not do a movie until he finds something he wants to do. And so they always interpret that as he's quitting.
Yeah. All right.
Well, let's start with this track by track, and we're going to make it sort of spontaneous. We haven't really talked about what we're going to do, but I think if we just look down the track list.
Rare. Let me just. Hello? And we're back.
Had to hit the pause button for a spam phone call. Very important. Track by track on Lunatic, we haven't really discussed what our plan is for this. We're just going to go down song by song and talk about the song, the artwork, or whatever comes to mind, any stories related to the song.
Well, I think we should talk maybe to begin with how we recorded the album. And what I mean by that is in 2011, we had just started recording songs because we'd released our debut album.
No, I think you're wrong. It's...
We've been recording. Some of these songs are from the 80s. But what I mean is, we had done our first album, our self-titled debut album, to nothing happening with it. So our focus was, let's just record songs. We didn't have Lunatic, the album, in mind. We weren't thinking, let's record an album. So we started recording individual songs, and those first five that we recorded and just put out by themselves, in fact, we gave them away for free for an email address, were It's a Good Life,
Sex on the Radio,
Sex on the Radio, Come With Me Now, I'm Only Joking, and This Time I Won't Forget. And we started just putting those out there, getting email addresses for signing up and get your free download. And then eventually we sent some songs off to South African radio, and I'm Only Joking just immediately blew up there. And then we decided, oh, this is actually something that's turning into a real thing. And we decided, okay, we need a real album.
Well, yeah, because it's the same thing happened in Phoenix with a guy called Beef Vegan, who's ran a radio station there called KWSS. In fact, we should have Beef on as a guest. I think he'd be a good guest. Anyway, so we had this little spark of success in Phoenix and then in South Africa, and this guy from South Africa who ran an independent label there emailed us and said, hey, you guys got an album coming out? We said, yeah, we got an album coming out. So we decided to finish the album and release it with this independent label in South Africa. So, you know, fast forward 6 months, we were scrambling to finish the album, and And now we should go down song by song and discuss them. So first song on the album is
I'm Only Joking.
I'm Only Joking.
Yes.
So I wrote this song, me, Jesse speaking. I think I actually wrote the melody, the instrumental of it, probably in 2007 or something, 2008. It was just sort of a Mediterranean melody that I wrote on the piano. And then I thought, this could be like a Mediterranean pop song. So I wrote like pop song lyrics and it had a dance beat and stuff. And then I just left it alone because it wasn't quite right. I didn't know what it was. I tried probably 10 lyrics. And then maybe around about 2010, I looked at it again and just came up with these new lyrics and a new approach. And we thought, maybe this could be a song for the band, you know, not like a Middle Eastern pop song. And I'm Only Joking was born. I think, I'll let you guys weigh in on this, but I think I personally can credit the record, the sound of it, a good part to our mom, because, you know, we were working in the studio and I was trying to get the song right, and there was like four bars in the middle of the song that had these big thumping drums, and I played it to our mom and she goes, fucking hell, she says, those drums should be in the whole song. I just want to hear them the whole song, just dum 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 dum.
So she really did say fucking hell.
Yeah.
The fuck are you doing, you idiot? I raised you better than this.
So I did. I went back and I recorded that sort of heavy layered drum loop on the entire song, and it led to the current sound of it.
Yeah.
And those drums we've talked about a lot are obviously inspired by Burundi drumming.
Yeah.
Which we'll maybe have put a link with each song on this track by track. We'll put a link with either references to some of the artwork and the lyrics on congress.com/podcast. So go check that out. Put a link to some Burundi stuff there.
Our dad had this tape. It was a cassette tape with drums from Burundi. You know, it's a region of Africa. And their style of drumming is they'd have, you know, maybe 20, 30 guys playing in unison the exact same rhythm. So there'd be slight variance in everything that they're playing, but they're playing on these big kettle drums. And
a bit like koto drumming.
Yeah, the way it was recorded also, it was so loud that the microphone was distorting, everything was distorting, and then you hear it on a cassette tape and that's distorting. So you get this sort of electric feel from these drums. The way, you know, when distortion happens in a certain way, it's very exciting, like a distorted guitar. And so these drums are distorting, and I just remember hearing it and thinking, fuck, you know, how do we recreate that?
Yeah, funny story about that. When our dad used to mix us in the early, early days of touring, he always had a hard time mixing that song live, because it's particularly in the last verse section, Jesse's singing a really low octave, and you've got these booming drums happening. And Mick, our front of house, had the same kind of realization after our dad gave him the secret on how to mix that live, which was, instead of trying to turn the voice up and keep getting above these drums, turn the drums down, which sounds like a simple thing, but occasionally you don't figure out that little trick. So Mick's like, I finally got it. I can get Jesse's verse vocal to pop out over the track.
Mm.
So what was track two? We're going to have to actually look at this. I bet most of us forgot.
We released different versions of the album. You know, South Africa got one track listing, and then I think the first release that we did, like we printed up ourselves, got another track listing, and then eventually when Epic put it out, they got another track listing. So for those people that are into collectibles, maybe if you find all three of them.
Well, I feel like the South African track listing is almost, because we had six or seven top 40 singles in South Africa. We were very, very popular there at one time. But I don't know if we would say that we ordered this album necessarily musically how we would have seen it go. We kind of made some decisions that were like, let's put a lot of the bigger songs up front, because we were still trying to be discovered. We figured, you know, when people go click down a list of songs, let's make sure we hit them with all the big ones up front. So the second song was Come With Me Now.
Yes, and looking at the artwork now, I had forgotten we did this. That's fun. Well, there's a two-dimensional man walking through these books, and on the spine of the book there's a cipher, and that, what is it? Does that say hidden message? LOL. I think it, if you apply that cipher to the lyric, it says hidden message, LOL. Yeah. Right? Yeah, that was stupid.
Yeah, we really had high hopes for people trying to decipher the cipher on the artwork. And
they did
saying,
it, because remember, we did the first artwork that we did for Come With Me Now was just the lyrics printed certain, as a cover.
With certain words that...
Yeah, but those were just words and letters that were highlighted in red. This was an actual cipher on this, on the bookcase, that no one actually ever figured out. And we all had high hopes that it would be a funny, you know, when the first person that figures it out and messages us and says, oh, you assholes, you know, I spent hours trying to figure this out. And then all it says is hidden message, LOL.
Yep.
Never happened. So now we're just having to tell people what
apparently
it says.
Apparently there's no Alan Turings in our listener base.
So Come With Me Now, Johnny, you wrote what, 2008?
Yeah, 7 or 8. I'd started, we were listening to this Kwaito music that we always talk about, which is the, you know, South African style of slowed down house music sort of thing. And I basically just had this loop going around with an accordion and drums, and that was really it. I think that for a long time that was kind of that I knew there was something in that groove and in that accordion riff, that there was something in there, but it didn't really develop into a song for quite a while. And then eventually got a full song out of it, but it had an entire different bridge section in it that ended up being Take Me Back. And that was something all the guys here, I think particularly Jesse, said, that's a great section and all, and I like it, but it does not belong in this song. And I fought like tooth and nail to keep that section in the song.
It was like a 5-minute song, and you know, we kind of started having this sensation that it's a commercial song, you know, and a powerful song. And then you've got this like minute-long section that's sort of a breakdown and a melodic anthemic thing that if you listen to the chorus of Take Me Back, that originally was in Come With Me Now. And if you think of it this way, you got two songs for the price of one out of that suggestion.
That's how prolific I am.
The other thing I told you to do, and this is kind of funny, is the Far Away section was originally only one repeat. And I think I said, you know, that's a strong section. You should do it twice.
Yeah, it's funny you said that. A lot of people in the business or the radio side of things said we should cut that section.
Yeah, well, that was the irony of it, is that I thought it was a strong section, so I said do it twice, and we eventually kind of all agreed on the format of the song. And then when the song started going to pop radio, probably, what, 6 years later, a bunch of business people or people who look at radio advertising all day long were like, you should trim that section. I think we might lose the listener.
They're freaking Neanderthals, you know, like 6 years later, a million singles sold later, they say, I think, you know, I've got an artistic opinion about this song here. I've got a creative opinion here that might be relevant.
It's kind of funny to talk about this song because obviously this is a song that we've become most known for. And I think a lot of people now think of this song as like, oh, that song. You know, it's overplayed. It's in too many commercials. They associate it with WWE or whatever Dodge commercial they saw it in. And now it's got this certain image that's associated with that song. But in the beginning, literally everyone we played it to thought it's too weird. Like, it's an accordion song with a slide solo and this weird kind of groove. That the first synchronization usage we ever got with that was that weird French movie called Holy Motors, a very obscure art film.
So yeah, it's anything but trying to be commercially, you know, selling something commercially. It's only about selling one thing.
Yeah, don't say anything.
The whole
like
kind of
we still
song
want the
is
money.
A bit backwards, you know, like the bass part is on the upbeat, you know, and like everything's quite backwards about it.
It's just funny that now it's become like, heard that, boring, you know, when we couldn't get people to listen to it. I think this song, and I'm Only Joking, though, also, there's certain songs on an album, and we're finding that even as we're recording this new album, that are difficult to record.
Right. There is definitely the inspiration part of songwriting, but it's very brief. It's much shorter than most people realize. It's usually at the beginning, and it's, you know, it goes away pretty quickly, and then the rest of it is craftiness.
Yeah, this one, I'm only joking, a couple more like that were just almost a grind getting the final record to squeeze out that little thing, you know.
It's like a bigger, more extreme example would be thinking that like Michelangelo was inspired the entire time he was carving whatever he was carving, you know.
David.
Yeah.
A lot of the time he was just like chipping rock away.
Track number three, I Want to Know. Jesse wrote this one. Jesse?
Also, you know, much older, I think, than a lot of our music sometimes takes years to get out, you know. And I think I just had this chord sequence for many years before I actually wrote the song. I didn't know what to do with it. And it's sort of a cyclical chord sequence that just kind of loops around and around. And I don't know. I saw the power of reggae. We saw a few reggae concerts, you know, including the Wailers. And it's one of those types of music that people basically dismiss because it's like, oh yeah, reggae, you know, that's part of everyone's life. Everyone likes Bob Marley, you know, so let's not ever try to make reggae again, you know, unless you're one of the sort of SoCal reggae bands or something like that. So I thought we'd just try and approach a reggae song and see if we could do something with it that was a little bit, you know, unique or a little bit Congosified. It's one of those songs I just like playing. I can kind of switch off and not think about it and live in it. And I can't. Do you guys have any thoughts?
What's it about?
I want to know. Let me remember now. I think basically it's about the difference between sort of philosophizing or theorizing or having an opinion, whether it's in a political opinion or a scientific or a religious opinion, the difference between that and, you know, actually taking action, and where do those two sort of lines meet. So I think one of the things I was feeling was like, it was around the time of the election, that maybe was the John Kerry, George Bush election or the Obama election. I can't remember. Very controversial.
That's how long our music takes. It's like Ford Nixon era.
Yeah. So there was just this obsession with everyone having an opinion about something, or, you know, science versus religion, and that people like foam at the mouth, you know, arguing about this stuff. And I thought, you know, how attached are you actually to your opinion, you know, and what is it, how is it in relation to the reality of things? Because what is reality other than your own subjective perception of it, and yada, 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 and I wrote this song.
And the artwork was, Danny, was that one of your pictures in Skiathos in Greece?
Yes, that is, we only found this out later, but that's, that mountain in the background is actually Mount Athos.
Oh, really?
That's Skiathos is a Greek island that we were at.
Because you can water ski to Athos.
Skiathos, I believe,
in the shadow of Mount Athos. Mount Athos is they've got some famous monasteries actually on there where a bunch of lonely dudes hang out, I guess.
That's a very
Athol.
Also, the music video for this, most people probably don't know the story that we shot another music video for I Want to Know. The one that we released is not the one we initially shot. The label put out some feelers to some directors, and we got some treatments for this music video, and we ended up shooting it in Brooklyn. And it turned out it wasn't the director's fault or anything like that. The idea was a great idea. It kind of lined up really well with the lyric and the feel of the song, but there just was not enough money put behind from the labels for this music video to work, because it was quite a grandiose idea. And
a lot of animation.
Tons of animation. If you have this big grand idea but not enough money to execute it well, it turns out the way it turned out, and so we had to shelve it. And
we shot it. You know, our parts were shot on a green screen because there was an idea that our faces would be animated and so on later. So when they send you little test clips of it, they just send you side by sides because they haven't actually done the laborious work of animating it yet. So they just send you a video of you on a green screen looking awkwardly at a camera, and then a kind of rough, you know, 5 frames per second idea of what the animation could look like on the right, and it looks so goofy that we were thinking of releasing the video of just that.
I got two things to say about that. I know that Mick and Mo both still hate us because of that shoot, because they need Jesse's drums every bit of metal had to be taped out.
Because it reflected the green.
Reflected the green, and they wouldn't have been able to do the masking on it. So they spent probably 2 or 3 hours taping up all of Jesse's drums, and then we didn't end up using it. And then when I think of that music video, I think of that Noel Gallagher, where he's being interviewed, or he talks about every one of his music videos.
Yeah, we'll put a link to that. Yeah,
put a link to that. And he just starts off by saying, I fucking hate music videos. I fucking hate everything about them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I felt after that experience.
Yeah, his philosophy is becoming more convincing by the day. Let's do Escape.
Escape. I think this, I wrote this one. I think it may have been the last song written for Lunatic, because it was, I wrote it very close to us actually finishing the album. And so a lot of things were swirling around my head, including this Nostradamus idea, you know, that the world was going to end and that the southern tip of Africa would be safe. It's one of his predictions. And so I had this feeling kind of just swirling around my head and my whole self, and when I came up with the melody and the music for it, it started to seem like a little idea, this sort of post-apocalyptic romance, you know, where the world goes to shit and you're just trying to get down somewhere safe. And I think that's the essence of the song, but I think our connection to South Africa probably helped that idea along, because we were already biased, you know, we grew up there and we have a lot of fond memories of it, and it still feels like a home to us. So that was sort of an inspiration behind it.
Yeah, if you did happen to make it to the southern tip of Africa in the apocalypse, it's not a bad place to end up. Cape Town, sipping on some...
Well, yeah, the whole music video was shot in South Africa, in Johannesburg, and then most of it actually in Cape Town and all the surrounding areas around Cape Town. That was probably the most fun we've ever had shooting a music video, because we shot it with one of our best friends, Michael Rodo, and... It looks like a serious video, but if you saw the outtakes, he's basically a comedian by day and or by night.
Yeah, the scene in the very beginning is Jesse's wife Rachel was in it, and Michael, and you know they see the terrible news on the TV station, and they got to get out, get on the bike, or get on in the Jeep and get away. We've got so many things.
We were trying to do a Michael Bay budget video. Basically, I think we counted it up. We spent $2,000 in total, and that included flights for everyone to and from Cape Town, and renting this motorcycle. And we kind of sourced everything we could from our friends to try and shoot it. So for $2,000, we were trying to get a Michael Bay size video. So I don't know that we accomplished that, but we had a fuckload of fun doing it. And Rachel, who's, you know, my wife now, was playing the part across from one of our best friends from South Africa. So they had to kind of pretend to be romantically involved. And that whole thing was just funny. Just if you see the music video with live audio, you know, it's like, Michael, Rachel, the world's ending, and listen, we've got to go. I'm telling you, it's like, it's bad.
Maybe one of these.
What are you,
days
what are you
we'll
still doing in bed, Rachel? The world's ending. You got to get out of bed.
Now, the last one was fake. This is the real take.
All right, number. What are we on? 5. Yeah.
Kids These Days. This is written by Danny Mee. Let me read the lyric quickly to remember what I was thinking about. I know that musically I was listening to a lot of Ethiopian music at the time, and that influenced me. I didn't realize till later, but the beginning of the riff is an Ethiopian pentatonic scale, just going up the scale.
I remember when you had this demo in your bedroom, you know, and could hear it from the other side of the building practically. And I just heard this riff going round and round, it's very powerful scale, you know, and then to put it in sort of a rock context was kind of fun to see how that developed.
I think it was funny because I didn't realize it was that Ethiopian scale when I was writing it, because of the context, you know, because I always heard that scale played gently on a saxophone or something like that. And it was played very kind of musically and gently. And then I think, oh yeah, that's right. I was listening to Ethiopian music and a lot of Trent Reznor. So now I can, I can see what was influencing this song.
This was your first ever song released, right?
Yeah, the first song that the public got to hear.
Because Danny, some people don't know this, Danny was about 13, 14 when the band started. So he wasn't old enough to really
write good songs.
I still feel that way. Yes, and lyrically, it was
quintessential Danny Congas lyric. Yeah. This is one I would say.
Yeah, it was obviously sardonic.
Wasn't there a specific story or like thing you had with some teacher in high school that?
No. But a couple of the lines are reveal it, like another war to end all wars. It's just a little poke at that. The Woodrow Wilson idea, you know, he said about World War I, it's a war to end all wars,
and it was just a ridiculous concept of using violence to end world violence.
Yeah, and if you in all the, you know, you hear like certain concepts like the end of history and all these kind of ridiculous ideas which get proven wrong over and over again, but the more general idea behind the lyric is that people have ideas and they have convictions and they're on the scale of a human life, but if we're subject to cycles which are much longer cycles and they have influence over us, then we wouldn't perceive them. So it's basically about the idea of cycles.
I just like it's a Spanish questionnaire. That's pretty damn funny, because especially when you actually read about the Spanish Inquisition and how horrifically
Was 350 years long
of just torture and murder.
Yeah,
you know, and to call it a questionnaire is just funny.
Mm.
And the artwork, I remember we were trying to come up with something for that, and we had those three items: the hipster shoe, the tape cassette, just laying around, and because you had mentioned the tape cassette, it was just laying around the ping pong table or something like that, and we just started throwing them up in the air, and you've captured a very quintessential hipster picture.
Well, when I first wrote that tape cassette line, it was not at the time that people were ironically listening to tape cassettes. So it was pre that. It was meant to encapsulate the little problem that they're all, you know, young people have a problem with old people and old people have a problem with young people, and it never goes away. It's every single generation perceives every other generation in that way, and they always find it remarkable instead of analyzing, you know, what is it about natural cycles that creates this oppositional position that youth and older people have towards each other.
I saw someone saying that if they wanted to get rid of Logan Paul on YouTube, they just need to go tell all the kids that are into Logan Paul, the parents, to say how cool they think Logan Paul is. And that immediately just kills it. You know, if kids find out that their parents like something, like, oh, fuck.
Like, we'll put a link to, there's a bit George Carlin's got where he talks about how he hopes that all disasters get worse. And then it goes into this super psychedelic thing where eventually the universe collapses in on itself and all of these Uncle Daves fall back into existence and a new universe is created with all Uncle Daves, you know, on all these planets around the universe, and all of them win the lottery every day. And my favorite line was, they understand the internet and their kids think they're cool. In this perfect universe that George Carlin, you know, is sarcastically creating. And it's a brilliant, amazing bit that he did when he was 70-something.
Yeah, it's crazy how he was so with it at such an old age, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it's because he had...
completely relevant comedy.
It's, what's the word for that? Irreverence. Like, it never died. I think that's one of the big things that seems to die in people as they get older, is irreverence. And it's probably for practical reasons. You get beaten down by life and you have to play the game and, you know, work for the system. But he still, to the bitter end, I think comedians do this more so than a lot of people, just say, fuck you, I refuse to respect anything.
I think that was also his act. I think his irreverence was not childish irreverence.
No,
you know, he was pretty contemplative, you can tell, in his normal life.
No, yeah, it's not a rebel without a cause.
Right,
as you say, it's basically not thinking that things deserve respect unless they prove respect.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what you're saying with, oh, kids these days, they don't have respect. The other thing I was going to say about this song is the accordion solo. I remember how we recorded this is I drank a bunch of tequila and espresso and went into the studio and recorded a bunch of amazing ideas that were very poorly executed. And we got the idea for the solo, not the idea to have the solo, but like we got the kind of shape the arc of it. And then I had to go in and re-record, you know, where my fingers would respond to me correctly.
Yeah, I remember that too, because initially I thought we had nothing. I was like, oh, this is not good. And then a few days later, I listened and I said, I realized, oh, it's great. It's just not great.
It just sounds like you had too much tequila.
Yeah. It's,
well, I knew that at the time because you can feel sometimes when you're playing when the idea and the emotion or something or the feel of it is correct,
right.
But the execution's poor. Yeah. So let's move on to song number 6, As We Are. I wrote this one. It's a love song, I suppose. This one is, I don't think we rarely, if ever, played this. Maybe once or twice at a show.
We started adding it in at the end of the Lunatic Tour.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Before the album came out.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we used to play it a lot before the album came out.
One that obviously people aren't as familiar with, and it needed more people to be familiar with it for it to be pulled off live because it is kind of quite a long, slow build. You know, people often aren't. You know, at a live show, you need to be a bit more quick and to the point. I guess lyrically, what I was thinking on this song is that the concept of love just seems to be so much bigger than we are capable of really understanding in most moments. And the idea that we say this word love a lot in all kinds of things, whether it's romantic love or love of a TV show and all that. And it just seems to be a misuse of the word. Not that I think, you know, necessarily anything needs to be sacred, but it probably would be good, at least in our own heads, to reserve certain concepts for something bigger. And I guess that's...
Well, I think with any big word, you know, something like love or God or any of these words that theoretically should have a very big, grand idea to them. And then you use the same word for, you know, how great this hot dog was. Same word you use for, oh, I love my wife or my family member or something like that, you know. If you use the same word for hot dog and that, then...
It's the Eddie Izzard.
Eddie Izzard, this awesome British... cross-dressing comedian who has this whole bit about the word awesome. And he's saying, you know, we use the word awesome. It literally means like awe-inspiring. You can't speak. There are no words to describe it. And he acts out this whole event of the moon landing. And they ask him from Houston, they say, well, how is it up there? And he's saying, well, it's awesome. And the people down in the Houston center say, awesome. You mean like a hot dog?
Yeah, he's previously described an awesome hot dog. Yeah.
He's one of the most brilliant comedians. What did he described himself as? A action transvestite.
Yeah.
Running, jumping.
Climbing trees. Yeah.
Yeah, he's hysterical. If you haven't seen his act, you should definitely go check him out. There's not much more. I guess As We Are has got what I like about it is the multi-layered accordions that we did to get a lot of those pads. It sounds very like you should hear it on a Scottish Highlands or something, almost bagpipey. In the instrumental melody that's played towards the beginning or the end. I can't remember. I haven't heard that song in like 6 years. Anyone else got thoughts on that?
Well, you could just talk about the artwork. Vitruvian Man upside down.
I think it's Danny came up with this. We were actually we decided that we wanted a piece of artwork for every song, and this was when we were recording this album for the South African release, and we were down to the wire, and I remember us all kind of scrambling
to try and find ideas. Public domain entered our minds.
Yeah, like, oh, we can just go search archive.org and get all of our artwork. But Danny obviously discovered or said, what about Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man? Because...
Upside down.
Yeah, upside down. It basically just relates to the lyrical idea that of as we are, like we cannot reach that far, meaning that we are potentially this being that is perhaps capable of love in the greatest sense of the world, but we are upside down or twisted around and not acting to our full potential. And that Da Vinci painting or a drawing kind of perfectly describes that when you turn it upside down.
Right. I think the power of this lyric for me is addressing the presumption that you can even love. You know, it's taken for granted that everybody just takes for granted that, yes, there's something you can do. And when in reality, maybe it's not something which is instantly available. Maybe it requires some assembling of yourself before you can express it. Yeah.
Man, this is deep thoughts.
Let's talk about sex on the radio.
Well, yeah, I mean, this song is actually about a very similar idea. It must have been in the ether while we were writing a lot of these songs. It's really a similar idea about constantly seeking instant gratification, where even if you have the impulse for a bigger emotion, that you don't necessarily have the energy or the attention span to try to create it or feel it or express it or experience it. And I really like Howard Stern. I think he's an awesome, like a hot dog, interviewer and a radio host. But I was listening one day, and I think he just had a porn star or a stripper on or something like that, and she was masturbating with the microphone.
That's the speaker. Yeah,
he's done it a few times. Anyways, I was listening to Howard Stern, and it just kind of hit me. I was like, this is ridiculous to be listening to this on the radio. It's like not even you're not even watching it. You're just listening to it on the radio. And now it's that was just the inspiration for the name of the song. But then the idea kind of developed from there. And also musically, it was just also in that same kind of Kwaito mixed with Maskandi groove and rhythm.
I remember when we were getting close to finishing the recording. And literally like 1 month before we were going to put it out, Good Charlotte came out with a song called Sex on the Radio. And we saw that and we're like, fuck, they're going to think we copied them.
Didn't you have a hard time recording the choruses on this? Because it's so high.
Yeah, I think I got them at the time in the demo. And then for months after that, tried doing it. And it was just too high to hit really well. I think we ended up using the demo vocals, which we do a lot on.
Yeah, that's something we've been learning, is record the demo stuff well, because you're going to end up using it anyway.
Yeah. He's talking about like ephemeral or nonsense on the radio and all that stuff. There's a book I haven't finished yet. It's called The Glass Bead Game. It's by Hermann Hesse, the same guy who wrote Siddhartha and Steppenwolf and all that. And there's a couple lines in it that are just so funny how relevant they are, because he's talking about a time previous to this futuristic time that the novel takes place in, where people were obsessed with newspapers and journalism and all that kind of stuff. And to describe it, a few of these phrases sum up perfectly our environment now, I think. He said, a torrent of zealous scribbling poured out over every ephemeral incident. This is about, you know, the period that he was living in, which was 100 years ago. And they struggled through a deluge of isolated cultural facts and fragments of knowledge robbed of all meaning. I was reading that.
Check the Twitter trending tabs.
Yeah, it was pretty funny to be reading that in the modern age and just have it be so relevant and even more relevant.
Well, how old is the book?
That's a good question. Let me look it up.
There's a reason, and I think we put those two songs next to each other for that reason. They were basically talking about very similar ideas.
1943 it was published.
So 1943, he's literally talking about the Twittersphere.
Yeah. It's, you know, you hear people say it all the time, like, you know, information has been made smaller and everything's less and less significant. But for some reason, his language is very insulting, and it's very quite
perfect.
A big dig.
Next song, Hey, I Don't Know. I wrote this song, and a lot of my songs, I think, tend to come together lyrically and musically separate. You know, sometimes I write the lyrics on my iPhone notes, you know, in the middle of I've written lyrics on a run and then scribbled them down before, and then music, you know, I'll try and come up with a riff or a rhythm or something. And then I find pairing, it's like wine pairing, you know, this lyric goes with this music. So I think lyrically, this is, it's about the formation of conscience, you know, in us, and how that plays out, whether in an individual or in a society, and also, you know, depending on your social status, you know, how does conscience apply to, say, a king versus, you know, somebody of the general public? And these kind of ideas were of interest to me at the time. So musically, also, it's got a little bit of the Kwaito thing, but more of a 70s-style rock riff with some African influence. You know, we're very hodgepodgey, I think. We find, you know, a pinch of salt, some pepper, some garlic, you know, taking different influences from all the music that we've listened to and putting it into our own custom mix, you know. And I think that could be a little spin-off as our own spice mix, you know. I feel like that's how I think of songs, you know, always food related.
You have a 12 jar spice rack with a song, each song having its own mixture. This track, we used to play this, I'd say, for like 4 or 5 years, where I played keyboards and did vocoder on it, which is not on the record at all. I guess, no, it's not even on the record, no. But we just played it that way, or I did that live. And then we finally decided, why don't I just play accordion on it, like, yeah, it's on the record.
There is accordion on the record, but it's mixed very low and it's not a major part of the song. But, you know, when you finally did pick up the accordion in rehearsals and play that riff, it's like, oh, it makes sense, you know.
It was because of the acoustic version. Oh, you did the acoustic version of it, and you played the accordion on that, and then we mixed and matched.
All right, I don't know if a lot of our fans know that. We have 3 acoustic versions of these songs out there: Hey, I Don't Know, Sex on the Radio, and
Escape.
They're up on iTunes and Spotify and everything. If you just search for Lunatic Acoustics, you'll find those 3 versions, and they're completely different.
Yeah, I really like the Hey, I Don't Know acoustic version. Completely puts the song in a different light, and also that's one of my best accordion solos.
I think one of my favorite about this song, the lyric, one of my favorite lyrics is the victor earns the title, the great, all the mysteries get unlearned, all the history just becomes a string of dates. It's, you know, this idea that depending on who the victor is, they get these different titles. It can either be Alexander the Terrible, or I mean, sorry, Ivan the Terrible, or Alexander the Great. And when you think about the great at the end of his name, it's as though he was this amazing, you know, leader and did no wrong, when really he also went around the world just slaughtering, raping, pillaging entire cultures and destroying the history of millennia of cultures, when he went to India and he went to, you know, all across the Middle East.
Well, one little fact that I learned, you know, that if you read about the library, is it
Alexandria?
The library, Alexandria. Something like 1 million books or parchments were destroyed, and this was thousands of years ago. So, if they lost 1 million, was it the Roman Empire? I can't remember. I'd have to do a history lesson, but idea that 1 million books could be lost, you know, and so what was left? You know, we're only left with the scraps. Can you imagine if we had had the body of knowledge that was destroyed?
That's a good thing to remember, I think, is if your team is burning books, you're the baddies.
But was it intentionally burned down? I don't know the history of Alexandria. I mean, I know that Alexander probably collected all of those books by stealing
or burning someone else's. Yeah, I think that's what I've always liked about this lyric and this idea. And the artwork also is kind of cool, of just this pawn sitting on a chessboard. It's interesting to think about, like you're saying, conscience in relation to a great leader. How do they determine what's right or wrong, and what is it right or wrong in relation to what? It basically shows how impossible it is to think about that idea of what's right or wrong in history.
The relativity of morality, you know, when you have power, or when you can, you know, flip a switch and it has an effect on 1 million people, you know, the dilemma becomes magnified.
Next song, Traveling On.
Traveling On, I wrote this song basically about wanting to kind of travel the world and leave behind people you love, you know, at the expense of that. And then
This is before we really done much touring.
Yeah, huh? It was before we'd done much touring, but the prospect of touring was coming up and being away for many, many months at a time.
Where is Barbizon? I've never actually known where that is.
Barbizon is in France. It was like a kind of bohemian artist village in France. And the song was kind of inspired by the Puccini opera La Boheme, which it's in the lyric, you know, dreaming of La Boheme. And then no one's actually really come and noticed this, but that line, dreaming of La Boheme, is actually the melodic line from the Puccini song Mi Chiamo Mimi, like the theme of Mimi in La Boheme. It's that melody that I took for that little line in Traveling On. And it's kind of like my favorite opera song.
Yeah, we'll post
time.
A link to that. If you haven't heard La Boheme, particularly, I think there's a Callas recording of it, Maria Callas, and then also a Pavarotti recording.
Yeah, I think Puccini is probably the best melody writer of all time. There's very few people that I think even come close to him.
That's why he's suing us right now.
Yeah, no, it's out of copyright, so there's no.
we can put that disclaimer out. At a certain point, you can steal a melody. All you have to go is look at Paul Simon's song, American Tune. It's a Bach melody. He literally stole note for note and wrote a song over it, which, you know, it's at a certain point.
Yeah, Wider Shade of Pale, same thing.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, this
if you're going to steal, make sure that they've, you know, been dead for long enough.
That's why I'm going to make my solo album is called St. Matthew's Passion by Johnny Sebastian
Bach.
Well,
yeah, just so that there's no confusion that the melody is very intentionally placed there on the line dreaming of La Boheme. It's like not an accident that it was
it's an homage.
Yeah,
Saint Tyler's Passion. I've Puccini Auto Beata. Okay, moving on.
Well, this is one of my favorite songs on Lunatic, and it was nice, I think, Sam, on the Lunatic tour, we eventually started playing this. And it took me a long time to I had the chords written down on my keyboard because I couldn't remember them because we'd never really been playing it. So I had them written out on my keyboard on stage.
The music video also, you know, back then and still constantly, we're trying to do music videos on the cheap. And this was the cheapest one. It cost us nothing because the public domain idea was also in our head. So I just went and searched archive.org for all of Thomas Edison's footage from the early 1900s, late 1800s. He went around the world filming all sorts of cultural events. And
like the World Fair.
Yeah, the World Fair, all sorts of interesting things from different cities and different cultures. And it was all up there for free, and you can go look at it. It's pretty amazing footage. I think some of the oldest footage goes back to like in the 1880s or 1890s. And you can see New York and Paris in those times. He was filming all the street corners of the markets and everything.
It's my favorite music video that we've done. Well, you basically did it. But it was like, you know, it's very hard to make a music video. It's just next to impossible to make visual images that resonate with the music. And this one, I remember watching it and going, oh, that works. Jesus.
Well, it was especially cheap.
Yeah.
Because not even your suit, you know, your wardrobe was not even paid for. You borrowed it from our Uncle Dane.
No, that's actually Dad's suit.
Oh, was? I thought
if it was Uncle
Dane.
Dane's suit, it would have fit me. That was Dad's suit. So the reason you're not seeing like anything below my knees is because I'm quite a few inches taller than my dad. So the bottom of the pants like come up to my shins, and it's tiny on me. So if you saw me walking around it, I look like Chris Farley, like fat guy in a little suit or a little coat, whatever. But it was a good-looking suit, so it's the only suit I've ever worn. I don't think I've ever worn another suit.
The only suit I've ever worn was when I was 6, because our good friends gave me a hand-me-down suit. I still haven't owned
Danny used to dress up. He looked like MC Hammer. He had this giant, puffy suit.
Yeah.
The suit has shoulder pads, and he slick his hair back.
Yeah. That was pretty cool.
So this next song is Take Me Back. This is the one I was saying I wrote. It was the bridge in Come With Me Now originally. And then I got convinced to get a twofer and turn this into another song. This actually started, if I've got the original demo, it was kind of like this weird bluegrassy thing, quite a lot faster than we play it now. And
I don't know if it was faster. I think the feel was double time implied.
That could be. It certainly felt a lot faster, and it was in a different key, much lower key. Anyway, so this is something that I had this song, and then I remember Jesse going to the studio and playing the drum groove that is in most of the verses and the intro, and that kind of was a new launching point for the direction this song could take, which is funny how sometimes that happens, where you have an entire concept in your head of how a song should sound, and then someone else listens to it, plays something completely different, and that's the direction it ends up going. This song, what else can we say about it?
It's one of those dark horse songs, I think, not like the Katy Perry song, but the, you know, it's one of the songs that we often get people coming up to us at shows or, you know, at VIP meet and greets. And without fail, within a group of, say, 20 or 30, this is going to be at least one or two people's favorite song, and, you know, favorite by far, where they're just like, man, why didn't you guys play that song, you know? And so it's... it's one of those questions of a set list, like how do you pick a set list, you know, and it would be great to get to the point where we truly just pick the songs that we wanted to play and not, you know, necessarily always thinking, well, this one's, you know, on radio right now, or this one we're trying to get it on radio, so it's got to be in the set and that kind of thing.
The, I guess one lyrical mention is, this is the Wise Men Said You're Amused to Death. That's Roger Waters.
Yeah, yeah, it's a reference to Roger Waters from Pink Floyd has a solo album called Amused to Death, which was an album we grew up listening to a lot. Our dad was a huge fan of it. I can remember driving around Cape Town or somewhere, and he was just blasting because Jeff Beck is on that album.
That early on? Because I remember getting into it only in a... I discovered it in our library when I was a teenager, and that's what got me into guitar, was Jeff Beck's playing album.
I remember it from earlier, like driving around in the van in South Africa, and dad just hit repeat on that one song that's got that crazy Jeff Beck solo. I can't remember the name of the song, over and over and over, and to the point where we're like, dad, okay, can you play something different?
Yeah, it's got the chimpanzee watching TV on the cover.
Yeah,
I guess lyrically, the talk of six while forgetting five, I just thought of this idea of people always trying to talk or think about, like, you know, do we have a sixth sense? And people always outshoot what we're capable of, you know, like we're barely doing a good job with the five senses we all agree that we have, and everyone's trying to get into, like, do we have a sixth sense? And is this, and I'm not ruling that out as a possibility, but it's just like, let's focus on the five that we've got. Try and taste your food. Try and hear the music you're listening to.
What if I told you you had a sense that allowed you to gather what was miles away from you?
Yeah.
Well, or if you could communicate with a person at a long distance just based on the sound waves they made. Yeah. If you put your five senses into objective terms, they're amazing.
And you can get this for $40 a month from the Apple Store.
We were talking about that when we walked walking away from a camping site, because we went camping sometime, and there was a 500-yard walk to a car, and it was pitch black, and you can't hear anybody. Just how amazing your senses are when you've got that little primordial fear of some monster, you can hear.
Just add adrenaline, and all your senses all of a sudden feel like a sixth sense.
Yeah. Well, Russell Brand had on his podcast recently a guy he's a psychologist and neuroscientist that specializes in the senses. And he was saying that this idea of the five senses, I know what you're saying by the sixth sense. Sixth sense is kind of like we talk about it like it's a supernatural
ESPN.
Sense. ESPN. But this guy was saying that it's one of the most outdated ideas, this idea that humans only have five senses. He says it's probably more around 35 senses, and that we just don't describe them in the language that, like, people can – we just don't really talk about it much. Like, the sense of balance is an obvious one.
Yeah.
That is not only a combination of all the other senses, but it's an actual – it's a different sense that we have. And it was just really interesting what he had to say about the senses.
Taste, I think I read some Scientific American article that said people can distinguish between, or they have 22 taste buds, which just distinguish between bacteria and threats, basically. So I've felt that before. I felt like, oh, it tastes like I'm going to get sick, right? When somebody coughs on a plane or something. It's either psychosomatic that it happens that I get sick, or that was a real sense.
Yeah.
That,
well, that's, Rupert Sheldrake talks about, you know, the sense of being looked at, that he says he can prove empirically, but
his feeling on that is so much more radical, though. His theory that he's not putting forth as a theory, but as an idea, is that you project the world outwards.
Mm.
And so when you're looking at somebody, it's not that they exist in the world and you are looking at them. It's that you're projecting that not into existence, but it's coming from you, that direction.
It's like the Matrix in reverse.
This guy was saying that we all know this, that smell has such an important part of taste, but that if you clogged your nose or if you blocked your nose and for long enough, that if you gave people things to eat, that they would basically only be able to taste sour, sweet, bitter, salty, and that when you taste strawberry or you taste the complex flavors of coffee or this or that, that it's mostly coming from your sense of smell. And so I was thinking, like, that's why Jason loves ice cream so much.
Well, it's really funny that you say that, because I just listened to a podcast, that NPR guy who has How I Built This, and he had the founders of Ben and Jerry's ice cream on, and one of them, I forget if it's Ben or Jerry, had a damaged sense of smell. So he would only judge the ice creams basically on, you know, a sort of reduced taste capacity and the texture. Mm. So he had a heightened sense of texture of the ice cream.
Well, have you guys watched that documentary on the sommeliers or the wine tasters?
I haven't watched the documentary. No, so.
It's pretty insane, because most of the time you can just laugh off, I think, people that have very strong opinions about wine, because...
Mm. Like, oh, is it the round table? They're all sitting around a round table and they're...
No, that's like Canadian competition where the sommeliers try to guess where the wine's from.
It's basically a bunch of young sommeliers trying to get their master sommelier... thing. I forget what it's called, basically a certificate or something. And it's truly insane the amount of knowledge they have in their nose and in their taste buds, because they are given blind taste tests and they are naming wines down to the year and region in France. Not like just, oh, this is a whatever, a Merlot or a Cabernet Sauvignon. Mm. Like, this is a 2011, and they'll tell you sometimes down to which specific farm it came from. So it's, you know...
And they're also very, very, very drunk.
Right. They always do those experiments where they fool sommeliers, but they do artificially manipulate them. And they choose... Like, it's not... how many sommeliers are there in the world, and then how many of them are actually good? So it's like, yeah, you could fool a bad one.
Well, yeah, it's also the idea I often like to think of, is just because you can do a test that proves most sommeliers are full of shit is like saying most people can't dunk from the free throw line.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean Michael Jordan can't. Like, right, we've seen him do it, and there must be within any discipline experts.
That Canadian competition show proved to me that they're legitimate. It's just, I'm just not that interested in it because I don't really like wine. So if there was a hot chocolate sommelier... Well,
you've seen the Angel Share, right?
Yeah.
So we should put a link to that. It's a great movie, kind of a small movie from Scotland, made by this guy, Ken Loach, who we really like his films. And it's about Scotch tasting, you know, and it's kind of a fun story about that. It takes how seriously a similar sort of story where they can tell exactly, you know, the year, the sort of style, or the distillery and all that.
Yeah, I have no... idea that I'm one of those, because I've several times blind taste tested myself on my own scotches that I know and like, and I've never once gotten it right.
You've got to do that before you start drinking the scotch,
though. But also, I mean, if you're pouring them for yourself,
I've had someone pour them for me. It's like, go from those three scotches there.
Maybe you should just learn to read, because when you're pouring them for yourself, it's really easy to tell which one's which.
So let's finish
See how
out.
Many different variations of this joke we can make of Joey.
Take Me Back artwork. That is a picture of seedlings.
Oh, yeah, the tomato.
Reaching for the light tomato. Those are your plants that you were growing at the time. Danny took this picture.
Yeah, I grew hundreds of tomato seedlings, or all kinds of seedlings, tomato seedlings, and those are them in there, like probably week one or week two.
Yes.
It's Good Life. I wrote this song in 2008, I think, and originally it was a sort of, if you want to use that word again, homage to Instant Karma. You know, I had Instant Karma going around my head, and I just was really into the recording and that song, and just the idea that you could make a song with that kind of energy and excitement and joy, basically. So it was going around my head while I was trying to write it. I was also trying to write something commercial, because before Lunatic, on the first album, everything we had written was very sort of, what's the word?
Self-indulgent.
I'm trying to find a better word.
Serious or kind of heavy.
Serious and introspective, and we had very little concern for commerciality. So I just thought, as an exercise, well, let me just see if I can write something fun. And originally the song was called Dog's Life, actually, because the whole concept of it, of just wanting to get away from the complications of life and forget about credit cards and receipts and taxes and all the shit that is boring in modern life, and go live a simple life where you just kind of sit in the sun. And I thought, well, that's a really good life, but it's kind of a life for a dog. You know, as a human, maybe we have more to strive for, more of an obligation. So
yeah, so you started off trying to write a lighthearted, happy song, and then you realize that it's this, you actually have an existential crisis, and it's only a good life for a dog.
Yeah. So, and then I thought, well, no one's going to get that concept about it being a good life for a dog, so I'll just change it to it's a good life that's more commercial.
I think I've always found a funny memory is, there was a fight at one of our shows at Crescent Ballroom.
Oh, yeah.
And it happened during It's a Good Life. And I just remember thinking, like, this is the wrong song for a fight to break out on. It's like, it's such a happy song. Everyone, and you can see it in the audience when we play it. Like, I like to look out at people because they really get into it. They clap along. You see, like, a different kind of smile happens on people's face. And then these two fucking idiots start punching each other, like, side stage right during that song. I just thought that was funny.
One thing I remember about this song is we used to play these gigs at the little place in Phoenix called the Lost Leaf, tiny place, and we'd play for 4 hours, and people would just kind of go with us. You know, we'd get 30 people in front of the stage, and they would just be there all night, and it was great training for us. And one night we played this song, and it was just way too fast. Like, we were playing it like 20 clicks faster than it should have been, and by the end of it I was like, oh, fuck it, I'm just gonna slow it down. So we kind of spontaneously did this thing where it slows down to a halt, and everyone thought it was cool, and so we decided to actually record it that way.
Hey, I forgot that's how that
I can always tell when the song is being played too fast, because the bass solo, I can only solo so fast. So if I start screwing up on the speed of, you know, some of those eighth notes and 16th notes, then I know the song's way too fast.
Track number, what are we on? Oh, this is it. Track 12. This Time I Won't Forget. I wrote this one, and I think we had talked about this before on a previous podcast, that Jesse didn't like the chorus lyric, but I finally got him to like it. This song was written, it's obviously about, you know, trying to remember people and even yourself, I guess, in the moment, and not waiting for the shock necessarily of losing someone to have that moment of remembrance, you know, because people always have that moment where they're like, now I appreciate my mom or my dad or my brother or my friend, whatever. But to try and have that moment prior to that, I think, is an important thing that, you know, none of us does as much as we should, but it's an important thing. It was written about this person in South Africa initially that we all knew, and just had a particularly emotional memory of him, and that I realized I hadn't paid attention to how much I appreciated him at the time. And just for some reason, he particularly stood out in my head as someone that I had done that with. Of course, we've done that with everyone in our life. We've not appreciated or shown appreciation to people enough. But for some reason, he just stuck out in my mind as someone that I'd been particularly guilty of not being aware of at the time. Mm-hmm. The
The recording's kind of interesting. I think it's very droney. You know, the chord, basically, the underlying chord doesn't really change over the course of the song. And it's something that we love about certain music from around the world, where it's modal, you know, so to speak, where it's not a bunch of different chords in an order that, you know, give you a certain melody or a hint at a certain melody. So some bands, I think, that may be influenced, the rhythm is kind of influenced by that band from Mali called Tinariwen, or different West African rhythms, or even Indian music and the harmony. And
I think this one specifically actually was this Moroccan music that I talked about on a podcast, maybe the first one, that healing Moroccan music. I actually found out now, many years later, that that's the genre that it falls into, that rhythm. You know, it's a very specific Moroccan rhythm. That is, like you're saying, just hypnotic. And it's being stuck in one modality of just sitting there, I think, allows for you to actually settle and sit in something. If you change chords, it's very hard to maintain a steady state of mind.
Well, I think this was probably the easiest song to record on the album, at least for me. The bass take was taken in, you know, we did one take basically, and the vocals as well. Everything, we must have
pedal
been
steel.
In a... Yeah, the pedal steel solo, everything was, we were kind of in a good flow state, and everything just, we recorded everything in like the first or second take and said, keep it. So probably one of the very few times we've ever done that.
Mixing it was kind of hard, I think, because I remember when we put the song out, or put Lunatic out first in South Africa, 6 months later when we decided to release it in America, we decided to remaster it and even remix some of it. And so when we took another crack at this song, I remember in many ways we made it sound a lot better. You know, it was like bigger, brighter, richer. There was more depth in it. And, you know, some of the, it was a little more reverb and like a little more sort of atmospheric. And technically you would say this sounds better. And then there came a point where Johnny was like, I'm not connecting to it as well for some reason. And I think we basically decided that the first mix had a certain intimacy to it. And then we tried to get back to that, basically, you know, remove some of the atmosphere and make it feel like you're right there with the band.
Yeah, I remember that now. And actually, even the first time around, a funny thing, when we were mastering a lot of these records and we're using this analog gear that's got tubes in it, those tubes heat up, and over time the sound changes. So I remember we had done three passes through of this song where they were labeled like December 12th, A, B, and C. And over the course of an hour, the sound changed so dramatically. And it was funny because I remember thinking the verses and bridge sound amazing on pass through A, but the chorus needs the brightness that came about in C or whatever it was. So, you know, it's crazy.
Honestly, it'd be very subtle differences, I think, to anybody who's not spent hours listening to this gear. But the fact that you can leave a piece of gear on, not touch it, and then, you know, run audio through it over the course of a day, it is noticeably different. So it's kind of a little like luck thing, you know, when we're mixing and mastering a track, you're like, okay, you know, get the thermometer out. The gear is the right temperature. Let's take it.
Take
but
it now.
The intent this revealed to, you know, the fact that you went back, remixed and mastered, and you got the intent wrong until you realize you got the intent wrong, you know, just proved to me that there's never been a good remaster. I hate on iTunes how, or on Apple Music, sometimes they'll only give the remastered version of a record. It's really annoying because
Graceland's one of those things. The remastered Graceland sucks, I think, compared to the original.
Because whoever is doing it 25 years later. They don't have the same interests or the same, you know,
it would have
attachment.
To be a remaster approved or initiated by the band. And even then, they're not necessarily going to capture what they initially got. But at least if they said, okay... We could, like Jesse was saying, I think on the remaster of Lunatic, we did improve 90% of the songs.
We were also, it was like a 6 month
delay.
It's not 20 years later by some guy in a studio remastering Michael Jackson. Yeah, it is another way of making money.
Like the record labels and publishing companies with their huge catalog. They're like, oh, what sold really well in 1978? Oh, let's do another version of it and call it the remaster.
Or let's try to make Michael Jackson sound like modern pop music. So why would you do that? Just leave it as it was.
That's also sometimes, you know, we get asked if we'd like someone else to have a mix, to do a mix of our records. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are a bunch of amazing mix engineers out there that could do a good mix of our record, but it wouldn't be the same thing.
Yeah, I guess we'd have to try it to see what that's like.
I don't want to.
Well, how long was this?
We've been talking for an hour and 18 minutes.
Oof, that's plenty, and you can't talk about this album for any longer than that.
No, it's longer than the album.
So, yeah, well, hope you enjoyed the track by track on Lunatic. I'm sure we'll do one for Egomaniac sometime down the line. You know, if you are listening to The Front Lounge because you like us as musicians, we will do this sort of podcast once in a while. If you don't give a shit about our music and you just want to hear us talk to other guests about aliens and conspiracy theories, well, we'll got you covered on the next episode, maybe. So thanks for listening. Subscribe, tell your friends, spread this around, find us on socials, all that shit. The Front Lounge with Congos. Cheers.